This is Scouting Telescope Beyond the Printed Page. I'm your host, Assistant Editor Camille Carlo. Today, I'm joined by phone by Dr. Jim Bell, author of our June cover story about NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been orbiting the Moon since 2009. In addition to his work with LRO, Jim is the lead scientist for the panoramic cameras on the NASA Mars rover Spirit and Opportunity, and he is also an expert on asteroids. Somehow, Jim also finds time to be president of the Planetary Society. So, thank you for joining me today, Jim.
Oh, it's great to be chatting with you.
So what have been some of the most significant results coming out of instruments on LRO?
There have been a number of really, really cool things that the mission's done. One is to create these beautiful global maps of the topography of the Moon, the highs and the lows, the hills and the valleys. And one of the figures in the article showcases that this garish color view of mountains and basins and valleys on the Moon. And before LRO, there were some sort of low-resolution data, some general understanding of the highlands are rough and the Mari are smooth. But now with the imaging data, stereo imaging data from LRO and the topography from the laser altimeter, we've got this just super detailed maps. And this is what geologists needed to begin to understand processes in detail. You know, did the lava flows or impact melts flow downhill? And where's the erosion happening on crater walls? And, you know, why are these hills particularly high over here? And is that hole in the ground an up feature or a down feature? Sometimes it's really confusing. So getting that topography has been a big deal and a major advance for the mission.
I found when I looked at images, sometimes I have to imagine putting my thumb on it in order to see if it's a crater or not.
That's right. You know, we're looking at such high resolution data, and it's often difficult for my brain to tell which is an up and which is a down. And the mission has also done some really great work advancing the state of knowledge of the chemistry and mineralogy of the Moon. You know, it's easy to think that, 12 astronauts have been to the Moon. We've had all these missions and all these past orbiters, and the Russians had rovers on the Moon. We understand the place. We know what's going on. There's nothing really new to learn on the Moon, right? And that couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, one of the things that LRO has helped to discover is that the samples that we have from the Apollo missions, which just sampled the near side of the Moon, a relatively small area of the lunar surface, those are not representative of the entire diversity of minerals and rock types that are found on the Moon. There's many other kinds of volcanic minerals and highlands minerals that we don't have in the Apollo sample collections. And we can tell that from the spectroscopic instruments and the color data. And so that's kind of cool. You know, we've identified some of the most important areas that we need to figure out how to get samples back from robotically or with human missions in the future to really figure out the details of what this little mini planet right next door is like.
So you mentioned a lot of the geologic insights we're gaining. There's been some hubbub recently about whether the Moon may have been geologically active in the recent past. Could you speak to what's the latest on that idea?
Yeah, hubbub is a good word because, you know, it's easy to think of the Moon as just a dead world and all the action was billions of years ago when there were lava flows and active volcanoes. And we know that the Moon had a very active and interesting early geologic history. And it's easy to imagine that, it's small, it cooled off very early, and now it's just geologically dead. But there were some hints from the Apollo missions that might not be the case. You know, the astronauts brought seismometers to the Moon, and they set them down on the surface. And they worked for several years, and they identified that a fairly large number, hundreds of moonquakes going on in the lunar interior, and some of them from impact events, small asteroids and comets crashing into the Moon even today, creating these little moonquakes. But others from deeper and from the interior somewhere, and it was just a small network set up by the astronauts, operative for a very short period of time. And so it's been this enigma, you know, what's going on inside the Moon? Is it really geologically active? And most recently, some of the images from the LRO cameras have been used to identify a global network of tectonic features that had been sort of hinted at from earlier images, especially the high-resolution images taken by the Apollo Command Module astronauts. This network, this global network of tectonic fractures, and the LRO coverage now confirms that it is, in fact, global, and these are, for the most part, what geophysicists call compressional features. They imply that the crust is being compressed as if the whole moon was sort of shrinking by a tiny, tiny amount, and maybe because of continued cooling of the interior, maybe because of continued activity in the interior. The exciting and confusing thing is that some of these fractures, some of these cracks, some of these faults cross what look like relatively young craters and split those relatively young craters apart or partially cover them. And so the speculation now is that maybe there is still some active tectonic forces going on in the lunar interior. The moons may still be active today. And the only way to know that is going to be to send a network of seismic probes down to the moon and do the kinds of geophysical experiments, seismological experiments that we do on the Earth to understand the Earth's interior. So there's a lot of interest in understanding whether the moon really is active and its inside and what that means for the evolution of the moon and its history.
That's really cool. So if you're standing on the moon, would you feel a moon quake?
No, I think the ones that have been detected are very, very weak. Well, maybe not a bummer if you're going to have to build a structure or something, right?
That's fair.
You don't want to be, you know, have to worry about, you know, the things you worry about in Southern California, for example. So, these are very weak and small events. The instruments from Apollo are very sensitive, and of course, modern instruments would be even much more sensitive.
So, some of the other stuff that's coming out of the moon recently is the idea of maybe water ice near the lunar surface. Now, water ice is a fairly common substance, cosmically speaking. So,
Right. Why
is there such a fuss over finding it on the moon or Mars?
Well, that's a great question, and a number of different ways to approach that. First of all, you know, the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, and it's a pretty hostile environment, and when the sun shines on the moon, it gets very warm. And so from just thinking about the physics of the situation, there shouldn't be any ice there, right? There's no obvious reason why there should be ice there. So what the heck is ice doing on the moon? And you know, the hypothesis is that many of these permanently shadowed craters near the poles contain ice in them, because if you were to put ice in there, the sun never rises, so it never will melt or evaporate that ice. And so there's a possibility then that, if that's true, there's a possibility that there are pretty ancient ice deposits that have been sitting in these polar craters and in the shallow surface there, in these shadowed regions, for a long time. And these may be icy samples of comets from the outer solar system, from asteroids, from different parts of the main asteroid belt or near-Earth space. And so we might have, just sitting there right there, right next to us on the moon, this sort of amazing potential sample return mission to sample objects from all over the solar system that have kind of randomly smashed into the moon over time. And that's got a lot of people excited. And ice and other, you know, water ice and maybe carbon dioxide ice or nitrogen or methane or other kinds of volatiles, that has a lot of people excited from a scientific standpoint. So that's one angle. Another completely different angle is thinking about water as a resource for future explorers. When astronauts go back to the moon, when people build moon bases and outposts on the moon, and those things will happen in the future, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years from now, those things will happen. It would be a lot more efficient and economical not to have to bring all of your water and oxygen from the Earth. So there are folks out there thinking about ways to process different kinds of silicate rocks that have oxygen in the mineral structure to pull oxygen out of the rocky minerals on the moon. And there are folks thinking about, you know, if there really is ice in these polar craters or in the subsurface at high latitudes, then can we effectively mine that and get that water out and have it be a resource for humans living on the moon, working on the moon? So that kind of live off the land perspective is one that the engineering side, the astronaut side of NASA is thinking about, not just for the moon, but for Mars as well, because it's the same problem.
So the current budget for planetary science aside, do you think that we currently or will soon have the technology that we could set up these bases?
I think that, I think that the technology exists if we wanted to do it today. I mean, we are much closer to being able to do that today than, for example, NASA was in 1961 when President Kennedy said, we'll go to the moon by the end of the decade. There are, of course, some technological hurdles that have to be solved, but it's not rocket science. Well, actually, it is rocket science, but you know what I mean. It's a lot of good engineering has to be done, but there are basic concepts, and there's no new physics or new engineering materials need to be invented to make it happen. What it really needs is the budgetary support and the national commitment. But I'm an optimist. I think those days will come.
So, on the fun side, what do you think is the most exciting or surprising thing that has come out in our understanding of these planetary bodies in recent years?
Well, there's so much. I mean, the textbooks have been completely rewritten in the past 15 to 20 years.
But what's your favorite?
Yeah, I don't know what my favorite. Of course, you know, the discoveries of the confirmation that there was liquid water on the surface and near the shallow subsurface of Mars, that's a big deal. I'm constantly freaked out by things like the discovery of the plume activity on Enceladus, this tiny little planet, little moon. There's no real good reason why it should have so much activity, and yet it's incredibly active. I'm constantly freaked out when I think about there are lakes and seas of liquid methane, ethane, and propane on Titan, and there must be waterfalls made out of the stuff that I use to barbecue hamburgers, you know? I mean, waterfalls of propane. It's incredible. And it's just the magnificent splendor and weirdness of our solar system is astounding. It's a constant source of inspiration and delight, and we've probably only scratched the surface of it. You know, so many of the destinations out there we've only flown past, and there are incredible potential for, you know, Uranus and Neptune. What are those systems really like? You know, Voyager sped through those systems years ago, and we haven't gone back for a detailed look. You know, Venus, what's waiting down there on that surface? What was the past like? Did it really have oceans? I mean, I could go on and on. I refuse to pick a single favorite. The entire solar system is turning out to be a delightfully interesting and confusing and exciting place to study.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. A pleasure talking with you, and take care.